I whisper, looking up and down the buildings looming around the courtyard, their high walls and arched windows. Learn about where you are. Find out why you're here. There must be a reason. Otherwise, why would he go through all this trouble to make me his bride? It didn't seem as though he intends to take me to his bed. He's neither tormented nor made sport of me. But there must be a reason. Hadn't he said something about paying a great price to find me? I can't remember everything he told me that first night, but I recall something about a scrying pool. Some mystery is going on here. If I can figure out the right questions to ask, perhaps I can piece it together. I look past the length of the table to the far end of the courtyard, the way the shadow led me yesterday into that enormous chapel. But I can't quite bring myself to venture back under the eyes of those cold, stern gods. Instead, I return to the corridor of stained glass windows. For the first time, I stand near the opposite wall and properly study the images in those windows, starting with the one at this end, nearest the courtyard. I frown, backing up until my shoulders press into the wall and tip my head back, trying to see the whole of the image at once. It's very strange. There's a woman, a tall, pale woman, a queen, I think, for she wears a crown on her head. A black band wraps around her throat, set with a blood-red stone. She stands over a large block on which lies a naked man. Dusky purple glass forms his skin, but the glass depicting his hair is black, so black that no sun can shine through. He lies on the block with his head thrown back, his throat exposed, and the woman, the queen, she plunges a knife into his neck with both hands. Brilliant drops of red glass cascade down his skin over the stone and seem to fall to the bottom of the window where many panes of red fill the space like a rising flood. My stomach clenches. I turn away, suddenly wishing I hadn't eaten so much. Seven gods! This corridor had seemed so lovely just moments ago. It shouldn't surprise me, though. It makes sense that a vicious, kidnapping Fey Lord would choose to decorate his home with scenes of murder. I move on to the next window, intending to give it no more than a quick glance, and hurry on to my room. But what I see stops me in my tracks. I look more closely. There's that woman again, the pale queen in her crown, still wearing that black choker set with the red stone. The dark-skinned man is with her, resplendent in gold robes, and he holds her in a close embrace. The passion of the pose is palpable, even depicted in glass and lead. Over their heads is a pattern of alternating suns and moons, three of each. 3 days and three nights. I move on to the next window, where the relationship between the pale queen and the dark man has fluctuated from passion back to violence. Here he is shown fleeing through some dark landscape of jagged rocks and pitted ground. He's small and naked, and she looms over him, a giantess of tremendous power, disastrously beautiful. She brandishes her crooked dagger like a lightning bolt. The sun shines directly through the red glass of her choker gem, making it blaze like hellfire. I shiver and turn away quickly. I've seen enough. I don't like this story, whatever it is. I don't like it, and certainly don't want to understand it. Gathering my skirts, I hasten along the passage, taking care not to look at the windows again. I find my room easily enough, and the door opens as I approach, as though anticipating my return. But suddenly, the idea of spending another day in there makes me sick. So I continue along the passage in the direction I haven't yet explored. Might as well see where it takes me. It ends in a garden. I emerge between two great pillar supports, my mouth dropping open at the sight, at the sweeping view. I can scarcely believe it. Once upon a time, the Normus family garden was tended and formal, a lovely retreat in which ladies could take their leisure. Back before the curse on my father stripped everything away, and both house and grounds fell into ruin. But even at its height of glory, Normus House had nothing on the grandeur now before me. From this elevated vantage, I can see down multiple tiers to a long reflecting pool lined with graceful, flowering trees. At the end of the pool stands a towering fountain wrought with elaborate gold figures, horses and men and monsters. Water springs from dozens of heads to fall into a wide basin. From this central point, paths diverge into long, rambling walks of shady trees, flowering shrubs, and formal beds full of bounteous blooms, the like of which I've never seen. Birds flit among the branches, trailing plumage richer and more varied in color than a queen's royal train. Their voices fill the air with sweet songs that blend in intricate, natural harmonies. Seeing it like this, all at once, is dazzling, overwhelming, almost sickening. I can't take it in. And it's... is it... mine? No, I growl, clenching my fists until my nails drive into my palms. It's a prison. He can say what he likes, but it changes nothing. You're trapped here at his pleasure. My knees tremble. Suddenly I see what my first dazzled glance failed to recognize. Surrounding the garden, standing tall and white and utterly impassable, is a huge stone wall. My legs give out. I sit down hard in the circle of my skirt and remain there for some time, just in the shadow of the corridor. Part of me longs to venture among these flowers and fountains, to walk amid those inviting shades. But I can't. I can't find the strength even to rise and return to my room. Not yet. I simply sit there. At some point, I realize I'm not alone. I know you're there. I shudder and rub my arms, though the air is pleasantly warm. I don't care for your lurking. Come out in the open. My voice sounds strangely commanding in my own ears. Funny how quickly one can grow used to issuing commands. Movement on my right catches my eye. With a fleeting glance, I see the faint image of a shadow, almost imperceptible beneath the full light of the sun. I face forward again, determined not to look more closely. "Milord," I say softly. "It is you, isn't it?" No answer. I glance again. The shadow is still there, insubstantial, almost invisible, but present. I draw a long breath, hold it for a count of 10, then let it out slowly. "Can you speak?" Still nothing. I take that for an answer. "Well, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised. Shadows are by their very nature silent, aren't they?" I swallow and bite my dry lips to moisten them. "So you're a shadow by day and solid by night. That's interesting, I suppose. Is it normal? For your kind, I mean." "No, never mind." I wave a dismissive hand. "I know you can't answer. I'm merely trying to understand it myself. That's all. I don't know where I am, you see. This place, this house, this garden. On one side of the house, we seem to overlook a cliff, but then this side is this grand garden, and I don't understand how it all fits together. I suppose we must be in fairyland. Beyond that, I have no idea." The shadow shifts. I shiver at the movement, but refuse to look his way again. "Mother Allah said that the magic used on my house was, I forget the word, something from the Moon Kingdom. But this hardly looks like a Moon Kingdom to me. Was she wrong then?" I bow my head, rubbing my temple with two fingers of one hand. It's all a bit much. I'm confused and frightened. I suppose I may as well admit it. Giving my shoulders a quick shake, I sit upright again and fold my hands in my lap. What are you doing here anyway? Did you forget your promise? To bring back proof that my sister is well, that your people did not do her harm? Or was that another one of your tricks? The shadow is still. When I glance at it again, it seems to have faded slightly. Perhaps maintaining even this amount of visibility under direct sunlight is a strain. Then it turns, and I glimpse a flashing glitter of eyes before it takes two steps toward me. It holds out one hand. My stomach flips inside me. I stare at that hand. So insubstantial, I can see right through it just like an ordinary shadow, save that it floats in the air before me rather than cast on the ground or wall. What do you expect me to do? I whisper, lifting my gaze to the dark blot against the sky that may be ahead. A face. Take your hand? Shake and be friends? I harden my jaw. I won't. The shadow continues to stand there, hand outstretched. What if this is another fey trick? What if by taking your hand, I'm inadvertently agreeing to something I shouldn't? What if... My throat tightens. I don't trust you. I can't. He takes a half step nearer. I shrink back, my eyes widening. Then something appears suddenly in the air, fluttering between his hand and my lap. It lands on my skirts, and I stare down at it, momentarily unable to make my brain recognize what it is. Then I gasp. It's paper. A folded piece of parchment edged with delicate gold leaves. My mother's stationery. After she died, I hid some of it under my mattress, and only one other person besides me knows where it is. With a glad cry, I snatch it up and clutch it to my breast. I lift my head, my mouth open to speak to the shadow, to demand how he'd come by it, if it was real. But the shadow is gone. 10. Surely not even a very powerful fae could forge Brielle's terrible, scratchy penmanship, complete with its telltale blots and bad spellings. Seated in the privacy of my room once more, my chair pulled close to the colored window where the best light can fall through on the page, I pore over the missive, desperately searching for some sign of falsehood. But it seems, so far as I can discern, genuine. Dear Valley, it reads, Mother Ulla says you've been taken by the Fae and are now a bride. And this odd little man showed up today and says I'm to write you a letter and tell you I'm fine. I am fine, Valley. I didn't know you were in trouble that night, or I would have been there to save you. I will save you. I promise. Your affectionate sister, B. I sniff and press a hand to my quivering mouth. Oh, Brielle. It sounds like her, all right. My brave, foolish little sister, who always chooses to be brave, never realizing how her thoughtless courage might put others at risk. Will she try to follow through on this promise? Will she go plunging into Whispering Wood, chasing the Fae who took me, only to be lost forever in Fairyland? I've got to write to her, I whisper. I've got to tell her not to do anything stupid. I spring up from my seat and begin a search of the room. Surely there must be parchment and writing utensils somewhere. But wait. I pause in the middle of digging through an ornate clothes chest, pushing aside piles of silks and satins and velvets to rummage at the bottom. Sitting back on my heels, I grip the edge of the chest tightly. The Fae don't write. I can't remember where I learned that, but it's common knowledge. The Fae can neither read nor write, do not understand the magic of making marks on paper to capture words and ideas. I won't find writing utensils in the house of a fae. I stand and drop the lid of the chest before turning to face into the room. Brielle's letter lies on the table piled with jewels, far more precious to me than any of those sparkling trinkets. I move to the table, pick up the note, and read it again and again. It is a form of magic in a way I've never before considered. A piece of my sister's soul caught in physical form. Something I can have and hold, even though she is worlds away. He'll deliver a message for me. He must. I breathe in and out, steadying my head, steadying my soul. I must get some sort of assurance to Brielle before the fool girl tries to follow through on her promise. I have to lie. I gaze down at the letter, which flutters in my trembling hands. Would an answering letter be enough? Brielle isn't a girl for written words. Besides, she simply won't believe anything I write. There must be another way. I don't venture out of my rooms again that day. The green woman visits me in the evening, trying to coax me out to the courtyard and a meal, but I staunchly refuse. I sit before my quiet hearth, and when the sun begins to set, and the multicolored light cast through the panes of my window travel up the wall and fades, I don't call the blue flames to life. The room darkens and darkens, and my eyes struggle to adjust to the gloom. But it works. Sooner rather than later, the door to my room opens. I look up and see the dark silhouette of my bridegroom standing there. Even from this distance, he feels more solid, more real than the shadow I encountered at the top of the garden. "Come in," I say, sitting up straighter in my chair. Something about the dark shape seems surprised. After a moment's hesitation, he steps into the room and closes the door before crossing to the seat across from mine at the hearth. He does not sit right away, but stands, a huge, heavy presence. I can hear his breathing, deep and full.
"Good evening, m'lady,"
he says at last. "Good evening, m'lord." I wave a hand, indicating the chair. "You may sit." He obeys. I wait until the sound of creaking and rustling fabric settles. Then I wait a little longer, my hands folded, my face calm even as my heart gallops in my breast.
"Did you find your sister's letter satisfactory?"
I flick a gaze across the space to him, forgetting that it's pointless in the darkness. "Yes," I say. I believe it is genuine."
"It is."
I grimace, but bite back a sharp retort. What is the point in reiterating my distrust? "I need to speak to her," I say instead. "Is there any way you can make this happen?" He is silent for some moments, considering. I wait in terrible suspense, hoping and fearing by turns. Finally, he says,
"If I were to find pen and parchment for you, could you write a response?"
"Yes."
"Would that satisfy your needs?"
I think a moment, then shake my head. "No. No, Brielle might think I was being forced to write it. I need to speak to her."
"You cannot."
My stomach twists. I clench my fists tight, forcing my stomach to remain calm. "Why not?"
"I cannot tell you, only that it is important. But a year from now..."
"Yes, I know." The words come out in a bitter snarl. "A year from now you'll take me home, but a year will be too late for my sister. She'll come looking for me, and then she'll be lost in fairyland. By the time you take me home, there will be nothing left for me to come home to." The air rings with the echo of my voice until the shadows close in tight, drowning it out. I sit staring at my hands in my lap, scarcely able to discern them in the gloom. I feel my so-called husband's gaze rest on me, feel the intensity of his scrutiny. In that moment, I think I might hate him, truly hate him.
"I will ponder this problem,"
he says at last, breaking the silence.
I promise I will find a solution that will suit both your needs and mine. Please, m'lady, don't think I dismiss your worries out of hand. However, there are other concerns at play here of which you do not know. Yes, that's true. I grind the words between my teeth. I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know why you stole me, why you insist on this false marriage. It isn't false. It isn't a marriage. Not by any stretch of the word. I would understand better if you had taken me for your bed, to bear your children, or merely for your sport, to satisfy your pleasures.
Is that what you want?
No! I bark. I hardly recognize my own voice, so sharp and angry. It sounds more like father's than I ever believed possible. I shiver and draw back into my chair. I don't want anything like that. I'm merely saying I would understand your motive then. But this? I wave a hand vaguely in the dark. I don't understand any of it, and I don't like being made to feel helpless. Another terrible silence stretches out between us. I take the opportunity to close my eyes, to breathe deeply and compose myself. What nonsense have I been spouting anyway? It was hardly wise to bring up the marriage bed question while sitting alone in this dark room with this strange man, this strange being. Then again, trying to ignore the reality of that fear won't make it any less potent.
Valera.
I shiver as his dark, deep voice rolls over my senses. I squeeze my eyes tighter, every muscle tensing with dread.
I will explain what I safely can, he says. As for the rest, you don't need to trust me, but I have my reasons for silence, reasons I would express to you if I dared. Believe me or doubt me, or even hate me, just as you will.
He pauses again, and I sit in agonized suspense, waiting for him to continue. At last, his voice reaches out to me across the space between us.
You want to know where we are, whether or not I have brought you to Fairyland. The answer is both yes and no. This house, Orokin, is my ancestral home. My family, the House Damaris, presides over the land from the Nestorian Mountains across the Valley of Rora. For many ages, we were one of the foremost families in the kingdom of Lunulir, respected throughout the worlds and realms of Elydria.
As he speaks, his voice seems to glow, warming the darkness with a proud light. But then his words trail off, and the darkness closes in.
This part of Orokin in which we now live and move is not Lunulir,
he continues.
Or at least, not fully. It is a... I'm not sure how to describe it. Consider you take a piece of cloth and fold it in half. It remains the same cloth, one and whole. Yet the folds are now on two separate parallel planes. Orokin has been folded, as it were. One fold of reality remains in Lunulir. But there are other folds as well. This fold on which we now live and move is many times removed from Lunulir, but simultaneously still connected. From various windows and doors, you can still catch glimpses of the original reality, but you cannot reach it.
I stare mutely into the darkness, struggling to follow what he says. Perhaps it would make sense to someone like Mother Ulla, who breathed magic every day. Even Brielle would better understand after all the time she spent in the strange glades and paths of Whispering Wood. But my life has been singularly devoid of magic until now. Why? I ask after a few moments. Why would you fold your reality like this? He doesn't answer. I pinch my lips together and nod. I see.
Something else you cannot tell me.
I am sorry.
Yes, so you've said.
I would.
Tell me if you could.
I know.
I shake my head slowly. Is there nothing else you can say? No reason you can offer for why I am here?
I needed a wife.
Seven gods above, I know that. But why? No, no. I fling up both hands in a sharp, angry gesture. Don't tell me again. You can't answer, and you won't. Just promise you'll find a way for me to speak to my sister. Promise me that. Please.
I promise to try.
I sag in my seat. Go away. The words fall dully from my lips. I lean my head on my hand, my elbow propped on the arm of the chair. Go away. I can't bear to be around you. Go. He stands at once. I don't look up. It doesn't matter anyway, since I can see nothing. But I hear the movement of fabric as he bows.
Good night, m'lady,
he says. I grit my teeth and turn my head to one side. Ears pricked, I listen to his footsteps retreat across the room, the door open and shut. Only then do I let out a long, shuddering sigh. Damn, I whisper. It doesn't make me feel any better. 11. The next day, I throw open the lid of the huge clothing chest and pull out 5 gowns. I spread them out on the floor around me, studying them closely. They're magnificent, undoubtedly. One is gold velvet, another a green brocade richly embroidered with silver threads. Another sports layer upon layer of what looks like Vaalian lace. Expensive. They're all human-made gowns, I note with interest. Not like the seamless white garment in the bathing room. These are styles and fashions I recognize. A little outdated, certainly, but no less beautiful for that. They're fit for a princess. Well, my dears, I say, raising an eyebrow as I survey the garments. I fear I am no princess, and I have need of your services. The green woman, responding to my request, finds and fetches a pair of shears, chalk, a bright silver needle, several spools of thread, and a little box of pins. She looks confused as she presses them into my hand, waving her antennae and looking about at the gowns spread on the floor. They are my gowns, aren't they? I say, offering the woman a determined smile. I suppose I may do with them as I please, mayn't I? Don't look so offended. I'll take care, I promise. The green woman burbles uncertainly and perches on the back of the upholstered chair, sitting with her knees up, her hands and toes gripping the headrest. I try to ignore her black-eyed scrutiny as I kneel beside the gold velvet gown and, using the chalk, begin marking out lines on the huge expanse of skirts. The green woman says nothing through all this, though every time I glance up at her, her antennae wave as though in quiet alarm. But when I take the shears and begin cutting, the green woman lets out a yodeling yelp of surprise and springs from the back of the chair. She tries to gather up the gown, but I brandish my shears at her. No, don't touch it. You'll spoil the marks. The green woman rattles off a stream of chirrups and squawks utterly incomprehensible to my ears. I shake my head and point firmly. If you're going to stay in here, sit. If you please, I add in a gentler tone. A few more angry chirps and an aggressively disapproving rattle of antennae, and the green woman lets go of the gown. Instead of the chair, she moves to the sleigh bed, where she takes up the same frog-like perch on the curved stone footboard. Not unlike Brielle, I think with a smile. Hanging around in my room of an evening, swinging from bedpost to bedpost. My smile falters and threatens to dissolve into tears. But that won't do. I need to keep myself busy, keep my mind active. I can't indulge in self-pity and despair if I hope to survive this coming year. So, Dashing the back of my hand quickly across my face, I concentrate on the task at hand. I cut, pin, try pieces against my body, adjust the pins, tack a seam here and there, and try it again. Eventually, the green woman slips from the room, only to return a short while later with food and drink. I pause to refresh myself, all the while silently studying the pieces of gold fabric spread around me. It's a jumble, a terrible mess of cuttings and trimmings and thread and pins. But I know my work. I know this mess is merely the thunder shower heralding a sudden break in the clouds when all will become suddenly clear. I finish eating and set to work again under the watchful eyes of the green woman. As the day wears on, I catch myself unconsciously talking over my work. This fabric is exceptionally good, you know. The nicest velvet I've ever seen. Mistress Petrin imports her velvets from Sumina, but they're not so rich as this, and they all tend to pull easily. What Lady Leokin would give for a gown made of such cloth? It's a shame, really, to waste it. I cast a glance up at the green woman, who blinks at me. I don't suppose you have any idea what I'm doing here. You don't look as though clothing is, well, much of a concern to you. Do you never wear anything? The woman tilts her head to one side and chirrups. Maybe you simply haven't had opportunity. We'll have to do something about that. I bend over my work, running a line of tiny stitches neatly along one seam. I wish I knew your name. It feels very strange talking to you when we haven't been properly introduced. I don't suppose you would tell me, would you? I look up again, eyebrows raised. The green woman's slitted nostrils flare slightly. Then, with a flash of sharp teeth, she says, I frown. Is that your name? I'm not sure I can say it properly. I clear my throat and make an attempt. It comes out all wrong. Harsh. Not at all the bright, liquid trill the woman made. The green woman, hearing my attempt, tosses back her head and utters a chortling sound that is unmistakably a laugh. I chuckle and roll my eyes, bowing over my work again. Fine, make fun all you like. I can't help it if my tongue isn't so nimble as yours. After a little while, I add, I think I'll call you Ellie. Is that close enough? Ellie? The green woman tilts her head again, first to one side, then the other. Her hands flutter, palms up, a gesture communicating the same indifferent acceptance as a shrug. All right then, Ellie. I stand and shake out my work, hanging it in front of me. What do you think? Do you like it? With a little chirp, the green woman hops down from her perch and circles me. Her long fingers pluck at the fabric here and there, and she shakes her head, antennae wafting curiously. She croaks then a loud, "Quarp!" that makes me jump. Well, I pull the dress out of her grasp. That's certainly a strong opinion. Let's see if you think differently when it's on. It's the work of a few moments to shimmy out of my work dress and slide into the new golden gown. I designed it to lace up the front so that I can easily manage it myself, and it fits quite nicely across my bosom and my thin waist. The skirt flares just enough to allow for good range of motion, but not so much as to be flashy. The little tucks and gathers accentuate my figure gracefully. I also added a tiny touch of lace from the Vaalian gown along the rounded neckline. The overall effect when I stand and look at my reflection in the mirror is lovely. I smile, a glow of professional satisfaction warming my heart. Yes, it's a lovely gown. Simple, to be sure, hardly more elaborate than my work dress. But the fabric is so rich, and the little details of fit and cut so subtly elegant that even Lady Leokin would jump at the chance to wear such a garment. My gaze drifts from my reflection to the other dresses still on the floor, bundled off to the side to allow room for my work. What might I create out of them? Their colors and old-fashioned cuts fill my mind with interesting ideas. Concepts I'd never had opportunity to indulge while working as Mistress Petrin's stitch girl. Would it be wrong to take this opportunity to explore the possibilities of my skill? Would it be wrong to indulge my creative curiosity? Or would that be too much like enjoying my imprisonment? The green woman appears in the glass behind me, eyes round and shining, antennae vibrating with interest. She touches the velvet skirt, tugs at a loose, billowing sleeve, and chortles, a delighted sound. "So you do like it," I say, smiling slightly. Then I pull the laces at the front of the gown and slide it off, standing in my linen shift. "Here, Ellie," I say, holding the gold dress up to her naked body. "Let's see how it looks on you." The green woman's eyes somehow manage to widen to impossibly huge discs in her little green face. Her sharp teeth flash, but the expression is eager, excited. It takes some doing to get her long limbs into the sleeves, for she's not used to clothing of any kind. Even when the garment finally hangs on her rod-like figure, and I've done up the front laces, it doesn't fit right, having been sized specifically for me. But Ellie stands in front of the mirror, turning this way and that, watching how the golden velvet shimmers from different angles. She preens and prattles and bats her eyes, flirting with her own reflection with outrageous vanity. I watch, chuckling quietly. "You look quite the lady. If you like, I can make you..." With no warning whatsoever, the green woman tears the dress off over her head and tosses it to one side. Then she turns to me, gesturing largely, pointing to her stomach and her mouth. "Yes, fine." I gathered the discarded gown off the floor. One seam ripped along the bodice, but otherwise it seems none the worse for Ellie's rough treatment. "I could eat, I suppose." I drape the gold gown over the footboard of the bed, don my old work dress again, and allow the green woman to lead me from the room and out to the courtyard. The table is set and ready for me. Suddenly exhausted after spending my day in concentrated work, I sit heavily in my seat and watch with idle interest as platters appear, seeming to run on their own out from the colonnade to spring up onto the table. Only then can I spy the goblin men carrying them balanced on their heads and the tips of their huge ears. The little men set the platters down around me and perform elaborate leaping bows. I lift the lids, hardly batting an eye when several times I uncover yet another goblin eating the remains of whatever had been inside. Enough of the dishes remain untouched that I eat quite well. Shockingly well, really. My appetite is enormous, and for once, I'm able to indulge it. So unlike back home. This thought brings sudden tears. I fight them back, determined not to dwell on thoughts of Brielle. I won't wonder what my sister is eating tonight, how she's getting by without me to watch over her. Brielle is tough, smart, and capable. She'll be fine. She must be fine. The goblins, as though noticing my sudden shift in mood, spring up onto the table again. As I watch, they begin tumbling and rolling about, their ears flapping, their bare bottoms flashing, their knobbly feet kicking in the air. They pile on top of one another, forming elaborate pyramids, higher and higher, until the men on the bottom struggle and strain to hold up the others. At last, they collapse in a pile of thrashing limbs, shrieking with laughter and rage by turns. It's a simultaneously ridiculous and impressive display of acrobatics. Unexpected laughter bursts from me as I watch, my voice ringing along the colonnades. "Thank you, my friends," I say as I finish my meal and stand. "That was charming." The little men elbow and grin at each other before offering final bows and scattering. They dive off the table, roll, and vanish into the shadows, leaving behind a ringing sort of stillness that's a bit unnerving following all the noise. I look up, noting how the sky purples with twilight. Another day has come and gone. Another small fraction of my prison sentence has passed. I return to my room, taking care not to look at the violent images in the corridor windows as I pass. The gold dress lies where I left it on the bed, and I touch it thoughtfully, fingering the velvet and checking the ripped seam under the sleeve. I can't quite bring myself to pick it up and mend it. Instead, I simply sit in my seat by the fireplace, waiting for the night to darken. When the room gets too gloomy, I call the blue fire into being. My eyes grow heavy, and I think I might let them rest, just for a moment. My head drops, jolting my neck, startling me awake. Have I been asleep? For seconds or hours? I can't tell. I sit up, stretching my arms, rolling my neck and shoulders. The room is quite dark. The fire has burned down to a pale blue glimmer on the hearth. I must have nodded off for a while then. The door opens. I tense in my seat. I almost look toward the door, but stop myself and force my gaze to focus on the low fire instead.
"Good evening, m'lady," my bridegroom says.
12. The shadowy figure crosses the room and takes his seat on the chair opposite me. He says nothing beyond his initial greeting. I hold my tongue as well for as long as I can bear. But as the moments drag out, my discomfort grows. Finally, I sit up a little straighter and, turning in my chair, face the shadow. "Have you figured out a way for me to communicate with my sister?" I demand, my voice too loud in that stillness. The shadow does not answer at first. Then he leans across the space between us and sets something down on the floor. I turn, but not quite fast enough to catch a glimpse of his hand before he's retracted it. I see only a delicate crystal vial on the floor. The blue firelight glints off its cut edges and makes the liquid inside sparkle like diamonds. The dark voice speaks, a low rumble like distant thunder.
"This is water taken from the star glass mirror. I had thought to keep a little by in case. But no. After much consideration, I have decided your need is more important. I want you to have it."
I slowly lift my gaze to the shadow in the chair. What does it do, exactly?
"It is scrying water. I used the waters of the star glass to discover you, to see your face and learn of your whereabouts. This small amount is not so powerful, but as you already know your sister's face, it should not be difficult to find her, to see her, and to let her have a glimpse of you as well."
I press my lips into a line, my brow furrowing. "I don't know how to use magic. I wouldn't know how to do it."
"I will help you."
"Now?"
"If you like."
My heart jumps with a sudden burst of hope. Will it work? Will I really be able to see Brielle? "Yes, please," I say, breathless with eagerness. The shadow rises. I turn in my seat, trying to watch him, to see what he does. It's impossible to discern much of anything beyond the short range of the hearth fire's glow, but I see his indistinct bulk approach my tall mirror. There's a creak, a groan, and then he returns to the fireplace and lays the mirror on the floor, facing up. He pushes it so that one end falls within the circle of light, reflecting the ceiling overhead.
"Take the water," he says. "Pour it on the glass."
I spring from my chair and hurry to do as instructed. I unstopper the vial and kneel beside the mirror, peering down at my own face, oddly distorted from this angle. Do I need to do anything special?" I ask.
"Simply pour it out. Slowly."
Nodding, I tilt the bottle and let the stream of shining water fall. It splashes and pools across the mirror's surface, but does not run to the edges and away. Instead, it forms a puddle, perfectly round, like a second mirror lying atop the first.
"Close your eyes,"
the shadow says. I obey. I hear him kneel across from me, hear his voice murmuring deep and low. An incantation? What would happen if I opened my eyes and stole a peek at him? Would the firelight reveal his face to me? And what kind of face would it be? The Fae were said to be dangerously beautiful, far beyond the beauty of humanity. Would my so-called husband prove the legends true? But he was clear about the rules of our marriage. I am not to see him, not even a glimpse. I don't know why, nor what will happen if I do, but I can't risk it, not if it might compromise my chance of getting home again. The shadow finishes speaking, and I hear him rise and step back.
Now, he says, look into the star glass.
I open my eyes and lean over the mirror until my face appears in the puddle. My own dark eyes, ringed with dark circles, look up at me, strange and otherworldly in the glow of the blue moonfire. I hardly recognize myself.
Speak your sister's name. The magic I have called into being should summon her. It may take a few moments, but wait, and don't blink, or the connection will sever.
I nod, my cheek tensing. Priel, I whisper. Priel, where are you? At first, there's nothing. Only my own eyes, staring and huge. My own face, pale and pinched. Then the water shimmers. Clouds. I almost blink, only just remembering to keep my eyes open. Brielle? I say again. Brielle, can you hear me?
She cannot hear you, the shadow says, but she can feel you.
My brow tightens. If she cannot hear me, then... Oh! I lean closer, my breath catching with eager surprise. Brielle! She's there. As clear as day in the water mirror. Behind her, I can just see an impression of trees. She seems to be in a wooded glade, crouched over her reflection in the same position I'm in now. Is she looking into a pool? Oh, seven gods, is she in Whispering Wood? Brielle, it's me! I wave one hand and watch my sister's eyes widen. Her mouth forms an O of surprise, then her lips seem to say, Valley? Yes, yes, it's me. My smile grows and tears sting my eyes. I only just stop myself from blinking them away. Yes, I can see you. I can see you. Brielle leans in closer, so close I can count the green flecks in her hazel eyes. Am I wrong? Or does she look older? Is her face a little paler? Narrower? Her features sharper? Brows drawing together in a firm knot, Brielle starts to speak again. No words come through, but I can almost hear her fierce voice declaring, I'm going to save you. Tell me where you are. I shake my head quickly. No, Brielle, don't do that. My mind whirls. I have to do something. Convince my sister that I'm happy, safe. I smile hugely and speak with care, enunciating words so that my lips are easy to read. I'm fine. Really, I am. And I'll come home again soon. Brielle's jaw hardens, making her look even older still. Her lip curls in a snarl. I'm going to find you, she mouths again and reaches out a hand. Valley! Perhaps she touched the surface of the pool, for suddenly her face breaks apart in a series of ripples. The pool of water rolls away, spilling from the edges of the mirror onto the floor. I stare down into my own face, reflected in glass. Brielle? Brielle? Oh, she's gone. She's gone.
I'm sorry, the shadow says softly. There was very little magic remaining. I couldn't sustain it longer.
I sit back, blinking hard as my dry eyes readjust to the darkness around me. Two tears escape, and I hastily dash them away. I don't think it worked. I lean back against the leg of the chair. I don't have the energy to get up from the floor. Not yet. She didn't hear me. She didn't believe me. She probably thinks I'm enchanted, that I've been ensorcelled into thinking I'm happy when I'm not. The figure in the darkness moves. I think he crouches on the floor opposite me, just on the other side of the glass, but I can't say for sure.
"I'm sorry," he says. "I can send my people again. Carry her any message you wish."
"It will make a difference." I sniff loudly. "She'll still try to find me, no matter what."
"Then I will send someone to watch over her, to make certain she doesn't come to harm."
I look up. "You can do that?"
"Yes."
"Then yes, please, do it. I would feel much more at ease."
"It shall be done."
Dropping my head again, I look into the mirror, which now reflects nothing but the ceiling. For the first time since coming here, the tightly coiled fear in my gut seems to relax, to shrink. It isn't that I feel safer. Then again, I've not felt safe in a long, long time. Not since Mother died. Not since Father drowned himself in his own grief and rage. But I don't need to feel safe. What matters is Brielle. Always Brielle. My mouth opens. A thank you starts to form on my tongue, but I stop myself quickly, closing my teeth and pinching my lips tightly together. I won't thank this man, won't even allow a momentary flash of gratitude. He doesn't deserve it. He's my kidnapper. I owe him no thanks. "Good night," I say instead. It sounds very loud and abrupt after the long stillness. The shadow is silent. Then he stands slowly. I glance up, able to discern an impression of a huge form looming over me.
"Good night, m'lady,"
he says. Then he's gone, shutting the door behind him. 13. There now. I use my shears to snip a final thread, then turn a shining orange satin garment around, checking for leftover pins. Holding up the finished product with both hands, I turn toward my watching audience and smile. "What do you think, Bergabog?" I display the tiny pair of trousers proudly. "You'll look quite a dandy in these." A goblin stands on my hearth, fists planted on his hips, legs widespread. His huge, froggy eyes narrow, and one ear twitches, considering.
"Bergabogabogabog,"
he proclaims at last in a voice somehow both piping and guttural. His wide mouth cracks open, displaying huge block teeth in a yellow smile. I slip down from my chair, kneel on the hearth, and offer the trousers. The little man leans forward, his long nose twitching, his huge nostrils flaring as he sniffs the garment all over. Then two nimble hands dart out and snatch the trousers. With a few quick springs, he scales the fireplace to the mantle. Chattering and muttering, he puts the trousers on his head, stuffing one of his huge ears into each pant leg, all the while kicking his bare feet over the edge of the mantle with no regard whatsoever for modesty. I sigh and rise from the hearth, brushing off my skirts, although moonfire never leaves ash behind. I eye the goblin. Something tells me you know perfectly well that's not where those belong. He stands up and waggles his ears, making the ends of the trouser legs wave like satin flags.
"Bergabogabogabog,"
he cries, twirls on one hairy toe, and ends in a bow. With that, he crouches, knees up past his shoulders on either side of his head, then springs, soaring in a clean arc right over my head and landing on the floor close to the open door. I try to watch him go, but he's much too fast for my eye to follow. His tiny voice echoes down the corridor and away beyond range of hearing.
"Gog, gog, 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 gog."
"You're welcome," I mutter and turn to my little table. A week ago, it was covered in glittering jewels. Those are now stashed in the bottom of the clothing chest. In their place lie shears, threads of many colors, Pins, needles, chalks, and trimmings. More of the same litters the floor all around, some gathered in baskets that I convinced the goblins to fetch for me. The left arm of my upholstered chair has been turned into a pin cushion, spiky with silver needles hastily shoved in place, while I dealt with a particularly difficult gather. I pick up a tiny bunch of pins and satin the same color as the goblin's new trouser hat. I'd begun to make him a vest, but what's the point? He might try to wear it as underpants. Though if he did, I wouldn't discourage him. I have become oddly inured to the sight of miniature, naked men running about the place, their manhood unashamedly displayed. Yet a little decorum would go a long way. Puffing a breath through my lips, I toss the bit of satin onto the work table and rub my eyes with a calloused finger and thumb. I've spent too long today over those tiny stitches. Time for a break. Only, a break means facing the tumultuous thoughts in my head. I let my hand drop to my lap and stare into the empty fireplace. Behind me, I hear Ellie's voice in the bathing chamber, singing some odd, lilting, watery song as she scrubs the huge pool. By the accompanying rustle of fabric, I gather that she's wearing the newest gown I made for her, a stunning creation of green brocade, fitted to accentuate the most graceful elements of the green woman's long, oddly jointed figure. No mortal woman could pull off such a garment, but on Ellie's, it's fit for any royal ball. It's not fit for scrubbing soap scum from tiles, however. I frown moodily, casting a short glance back over my shoulder. I'd offered to help, of course, but the green woman shooed me from the room with one webbed hand. The people of Orican House are determined to treat their master's human wife like a fine lady, regardless of my wishes in the matter. Between Ellie and the goblins, they cook, clean, fetch, carry, scold, pinch, cajole, and wheedle by turns until I feel quite exhausted with being so God's blighted cared for. But now that my initial fears have faded, I can't deny that it's been a restful week. I've eaten and slept and bathed and created, with never a worry about where my next meal will come from or when the next blow will fall. It would be all too easy to relax and accept this new reality, to enjoy the luxuries provided. Jaw firming, I sit bolt upright in my chair. After a quick drum of fingers on my armrests, I stand abruptly. "I'm going for a walk, Ellie," I call over my shoulder toward the bathing chamber. "I'll be back for supper." Some weird trilling chirrup echoes against the tiles. Smiling, I step from my room into the windowed passage. Funny how quickly I've grown used to communicating with a being whose language is so entirely different from my own. My smile vanishes as I take the left turn down the hall and set out with a quick stride. It isn't funny. Not really. Sure, I may be growing accustomed to the strangeness of my new surroundings, to the oddities of the folk with whom I share this enormous house. But funny isn't the right word. It's now been 10 days since I stepped across my father's threshold into this new life. 7 days since I last spoke to my so-called bridegroom. Since that night over the scrying water, I've taken care to keep my fire burning bright until well after I fall asleep. He hasn't visited, and I haven't caught so much as a glimpse of a flitting shadow. Stepping through the patches of colored light cast through the windows, I clench my hands in the folds of my skirt. At first, I took comfort from Lord Damaris's promise to send someone to watch over Brielle. But as the days wore on, worry crept in. I know my sister. I know Brielle won't be able to leave well enough alone. Fear for me will drive her deeper and deeper into Whispering Wood as she seeks to find ways through to Fairyland. I've got to stop her. I've got to return to her before she gets herself into trouble so deep she can never escape. Lord Damaris has been clear about the year and a day limit to our marriage, but again and again, I've pondered his words, considered all that he told me from as many angles as I can. There's little enough to go on, but I think I've reached a conclusion. At least, I hope so. The passage ends. I blink and shade my eyes as I gaze into the magnificent garden stretched out before me. Several times now, I've ventured out to explore its many paths and groves, breathing deep of the gently perfumed air and resting my eyes from too much concentrated needlework. I already have a favorite spot, a winding path along the banks of a lily pond, shaded by pink, flowering fruit trees. There's a stone bench nestled among the roots of the largest, most gnarled of the fruit trees, and I sit there for hours at a time, watching bright-colored water birds bathe in the shallows of the pool, while enormous, flame-colored fish idle away the days just beneath the glassy surface. I make my way there now, stepping from full sunlight into the shadows of the trees. I trail my fingers through the low-hanging boughs, relishing the softness of their pink flower petals. Softer than velvet, softer than silk. What would it be like to make a gown out of these? A foolish fancy, but the air of this world sometimes makes the most foolish fancies seem possible. Turning a corner, I come in sight of the bench. I stop short. A frown puckers my brow as I peer into the shadow cast by that huge old tree. Was the bench empty or... No. No, the air is slightly darker there, forming a silhouette I recognize. I swallow hard. Has he seen me too? It's almost impossible to tell. But yes, he seems to be turned my way. Has he observed my comings and goings over the last week and realized this has become a favorite haunt? Perhaps I should turn on my heel and hurry back the way I came. But I can't avoid him forever. And if I want to get home to Brielle sooner rather than later... I gather the folds of my work gown in both hands and, setting my jaw, approach the bench. I perch carefully at the far end, leaving as much space between the shadow and me as I can. "My lord," I say politely. Though he doesn't answer aloud, I can almost imagine that dark, bone-chilling voice responding in kind, "My lady." For a while, we sit in silence. I watch the play of sunlight through the blossoms, the contrast of pink petals against dark branches and bright sky. A bird with a bright yellow belly and a white crest sings cheerfully at the edge of the pond as it flutters its wings, spraying droplets every which way. I close my eyes, drinking in the sweet perfumed air. "I've been thinking," I say, opening my eyes again slowly, "about our situation, this marriage, as you insist upon calling it." The shadow is so still that I cast a quick glance its way, again wondering if I imagined seeing something there. It's almost invisible, but when I told